More at Capterra.com.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Loray. Well, coming up today, Adam Smith is leaving his post as the political editor at the Tampa Bay Times. This is his last day. We'll be talking with him in a moment about Florida politics, about his career and the future of newspapers. But first, this Saturday evening, the group Florida Veterans for Common Sense has its annual dinner, and they always bring in incredible speakers. This year, their main speaker will be retired Colonel Andrew Basevich. He's a professor emeritus of international relations and history at Boston University. He's also a retired career Army officer in the Armor Branch. Basevich has been a persistent vocal critic of the U.S. occupation of Iraq, calling the conflict and the invasion a catastrophic failure. In March 2007, he described George W. Bush's endorsement of such preventive wars as immoral, illicit, and imprudent. His son, Andrew Basevich Jr., also an Army officer, died in fighting in the Iraq War in May of 2007. Basevich writes for many publications, including The Nation magazine and The American Conservative. He's the author of several books, including America's War, and I spoke with him on Monday. Andrew Basevich, welcome to WMNF. Good to have you here.
Oh, thank you.
I want to ask you, first of all, there are reports that negotiators for the U.S. and Taliban, the Taliban have reached agreements in principle on key issues for a peace deal that would end 17 years of war. What's your take on that?
Well, I feel a profound sense of ambivalence. I mean, I've long believed that from the perspective of U.S. interests, this war was misguided, unwinnable, a waste of money, a waste of lives. And so if we're going to get out, if indeed these reports turn out to be true, then on the one hand, I applaud that. I think this has been a catastrophic mistake on our part. On the other hand, we have to be conscious of the fact that we made a series of promises to the Afghan people, dating from the entry of U.S. forces into the country back in 2001, filled with, you know, language about democracy and women's rights and so on. And those promises have not been fulfilled. And in all likelihood, we can't know for sure, but in all likelihood, if there is a complete withdrawal of U.S. forces, then we may well see the return of the Taliban to power. And all of our promises will turn out to be simply hot air. And you have to feel some regret when contemplating that prospect.
And all those lives, both American lives and the lives of the Afghans, and all the money from our treasury down the drain.
Yeah, you know, you have to wonder, if indeed the deal is, the essence of the deal is, we agree to withdraw our forces, and the Taliban agrees not to allow Afghanistan to become a place from which terrorist attacks are launched on the United States. You really have to wonder if forceful diplomacy back at the end of 2001 might have reached that same deal. But instead, we've got, you know, 17, 18 years of war, and we're back where we started. I mean, from a historian's perspective, you know, if you set aside the human dimensions of this story, from a historian's perspective, this is a failure of U.S. policy. I mean, it's a military failure. It's a foreign policy failure. Ostensibly, the strongest country in the world with the strongest military in all of history. And we have just flat out failed to do what we set out to do. And I think that should matter in the sense that we should, if indeed we're leaving Afghanistan, we should do it chastened, with a far more realistic understanding of what our power can do and can't do. And therefore, maybe going forward, we'd show a little bit more modesty than we did back when feelings were so strong after 9/11.
Recently, it was reported by the Inspector General that the U.S. has spent $130 billion trying to build up the nation of Afghanistan. There have been $951 million for fines and settlements with contractors that have been part of that buildup. I mean, and this excludes the cost of the war, $130 billion to try to build that nation.
Yeah, it is a fact. I mean, it's been reported, but it's one of those facts that doesn't really sort of sink in. It is a fact that we've spent more money trying to rebuild Afghanistan than we spent back in the wake of World War II. And the Marshall Plan actually seemed to produce some positive outcomes. This far larger sum has produced none at all. You refer to the Special Inspector General. That's a team that's been rendering these reports on the reconstruction effort, and I think it's on a quarterly basis. And you put them all together, and you have a remarkable testimony of incompetence, corruption, that gets reported. You know, it gets a little, you know, a little article back there on page A15, but has had zero political salience. And that's also part of the tragedy here.
Our guest is Andrew Bacevich. He's a professor emeritus of history and international relations at Boston University. Among his books, America's War for the Greater Middle East, A Military History. He is going to speak this Saturday in Bradenton as part of the Florida Veterans for Common Sense celebration of Tom Paine. I'll tell you more about that at the end. So I see you're planning to talk about our current foreign policy. You say it's short-sighted and ahistorical. And you blame both Republicans and Democrats for that. Could you give us a kind of a brief idea why you think our foreign policy is short-sighted?
Well, this is what I'll talk about at the dinner. But, I mean, the gist of the argument I want to present is that when the Cold War ended, Berlin Wall went down, Soviet Empire collapsed, and then the Soviet Union collapsed, that at that moment in time, we collectively succumbed to hubris. Now, we, more specifically, it was policy intellectuals, you know, the so-called thought leaders, who believed that, in a phrase that dates from that time, and it became very famous, who believed that the end of history had now arrived, and that the end of history had positioned the United States so that we were supreme. And out of that hubris came a set of dumb ideas that, I would argue, formed the basis of policy since then. One of those dumb ideas was the notion that globalization was going to make everybody rich. Turned out that globalization makes somebody rich and leaves a whole lot of other people behind, so that we have this extraordinary inequality in our country. One of the factors, not the only one of the factors that led to the election of Donald Trump. We also had a form of militarism, a belief that the United States military was the best in the world, nothing could stop our troops, and that became the basis of a number of reckless armed interventions, Afghanistan being one of them. Even more prominent would be the intervention in Iraq in 2003. You know, tally up how much money has been lost, how many U.S. casualties have been suffered, how many others, people we've killed or turned into refugees, and you sort of scratch your head and say, toward what end? I mean, what good came out of the fact that we have been continuously at war for, you know, going on almost two decades now? So this militarism, I think that's what it has to be called, that was also a product of the post-Cold War era, was another one of those dumb ideas that sent us down a wrong path and that has wreaked terrible harm, I think.
You know, I don't know every place the U.S. is at war right now, but it seems to me it's far more than Afghanistan in Iraq. It includes backing up Saudi Arabia and Yemen. It includes Syria and then parts of Africa.
But Somalia. Yeah, I mean, you're exactly right. And in the sense, most of us don't know all the places where we're at war. Much of it's fairly small-scale operations, but it's come to be accepted, as it were, that the executive branch, the commander-in-chief, can, you know, pretty much use force wherever, you know, he deems it he deems it necessary. It's remarkably little accountability, remarkably little even discussion. You know, of the Yemen war. I mean, it's a catastrophe. Now, it's not American pilots dropping bombs in Yemen. No, it's Americans selling weapons to the Saudis, refueling Saudi airplanes, providing targeting data to Saudi planners, and so our fingerprints are all over that disaster. And then you back up and you say, well, why are we there? And the answer, I guess, is that we're there supporting Saudi Arabia because the Saudis think that the problem in Yemen is part of the larger dispute that they're having with Iran. Why do we tilt in favor of Saudi Arabia? Beats the heck out of me.
We're talking with Colonel Andrew Basevich. He'll be speaking this Saturday night in Bradenton. This is WMNF in Tampa. You know, the argument always, though, is if we don't fight them over there, we're going to fight them over here, that we're fighting Islamic radicalism of some brand, and we're trying to prevent it from spreading all over the world. What do you make of that argument?
Well, I think the facts would say we've actually spread it. I mean, I don't for a second believe that Islamic terrorism poses anything like an existential threat to the United States. It's a problem. It's a problem that deserves attention. I don't think it's a problem to which war provides a solution. I think we should view it as large-scale criminality operating on an international basis. And to the extent that there is a solution, the solution is an international, a well-funded, sustained international police effort to which we would contribute, but to which others would as well. You know, terrorism is not simply a threat to the United States. It's a threat to a lot of different countries, and therefore there is an opportunity to make common cause with others to deal with this problem. But again, the bottom line here would be we've tried war as a way to deal with terrorism, and we can see the consequences everywhere. We can see the consequences in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Syria, and on and on.
Yeah, you mentioned we've been talking a little bit about Saudi Arabia and the U.S. taking sides in this kind of regional conflict between Iran and Saudi Arabia. To what extent is the Islamic terrorism that we worry about, like let's say groups like ISIS, to what extent is Saudi Arabia responsible for this Islamic terrorism?
Well, I think that we know. I mean, there's an abundance of evidence that the Saudi royal family has promoted an extremist form of Islam. They have funded schools. They have, you know, built places of worship. And I think they've done that because they're trying to divert criticism from within Saudi Arabia that could potentially pose a threat to their hold on power. And they've been doing this for years and years, and it worked. I mean, it worked in the sense that it has fueled an increase in radical Islamist thinking in across a large part of the greater Middle East. So I think it would be unfair to say that that's the only source of the problem. I think it would be fair to say that that certainly has exacerbated the problem. But, you know, so have our own actions in, you know, going back as far as the 1950s when we overthrew the democratically elected government of Iran. You know, people can disagree on U.S. support for Israel, but I don't think they can disagree that U.S. support for Israel has, in fact, rubbed some in the Arab world, specifically, the wrong way, and that has contributed to the animosity directed against the United States that terrorist organizations exploit.
And one final question for me is that if you were to look at terrorism supported by the nation of Iran and terrorism supported by the nation of Saudi Arabia, either through official government funding or through private funding from Saudi Arabia, which is worse? Which presents a greater threat to world peace?
Well, I don't. It's a very good question, and the answer is I don't know. What I would say is that the competition between those two countries, seeking dominion in the Persian Gulf is a conflict in which we, you know, we shouldn't take sides. Neither of those countries reflects the values that we purport to represent. And although certainly our position should be that we want to do whatever we can to promote stability and avert conflict, to try to do that by siding with one against the other, I think, is a mistake.
Colonel Basevich, I know you're getting ready to come here to Florida, so I don't want to take too much more of your time, but is there anything else that you'd like to point out about our current military situation or current foreign policy situation that you think is important for our audience to know?
Well, not right now. I'm looking forward to this Tom Paine dinner where I'm going to make a presentation this weekend, and I hope that'll, you know, result in a lively conversation.
Colonel Basevich, thank you very much for coming on WMNF.
Thank you.
That's retired Colonel Andrew Basevich. He was in the U.S. Army. He's a professor emeritus of international relations and history at Boston University. He's the author of several books, including America's War. He's going to be speaking this Saturday evening between 6 and 9 p.m. in Bradenton at the annual dinner of Florida Veterans for Common Sense. And for ticket information, you can call 941-321-4774. That's 941-321-4774. Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. I'm Rob Lorack. Well, next up, Adam Smith is the political editor for the Tampa Bay Times. He focuses on state and national politics. He's the creator of the award-winning Florida politics blog, The Buzz. He's been with the Times since 1992. Adam Smith grew up in New York City, graduated from Kenyon College in Ohio, and last week he announced he's leaving his job at the Times and joining the local office of a public relations firm. And Adam Smith joins us right now on the phone. Adam, thanks for coming on MNF. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
This is really a terrible day, Adam. You're leaving the Times. This is awful.
It's bittersweet for me. It's very weird to walk out of this office soon after a heck of a long time, almost three decades. But I'm ready. You know, change is good, hopefully.
So, Adam, how long have you been the political editor at the Times?
Forever. since 2001, just as the big story was Bill McBride versus Janet Reno for the Democratic nomination to challenge Jeb Bush. So that's like 17 years.
I remember that campaign. There was a lot of optimism that Bill McBride would win the governorship and then eventually run for president.
I still look back at that and think the press was too hard on Janet Reno and too soft on Bill McBride.
Because McBride didn't have any answers to some of the questions, like how would he pay for some of his programs?
Yeah, he just turned out to be, that's the last time there's been a governor's race where it really was pretty much of a blowout. Jeb Bush pretty much blew him out. I think McBride was proved to be a very nice guy, really a true leader, and in some ways a visionary in business, but not a great candidate all along, not just because he was so vague on some key issues.
Adam, how far did you travel? How many places did you go? What's the most amazing place you went to as in your job as the political editor at the Times?
Boy, that's a tough question. I certainly have a lot of memories of deep, deep, brutal snowstorms in Iowa, chasing around candidates and people like Dick Gephardt and John Kerry and Obama. But I can't think what's the most exotic place I've been. There's got to be a lot.
The what?
There has to be a lot. Maybe it's Florida, but I've been to so many places I can't think of what is probably the peak.
Do you have a peak moment in your career as a political editor? Something that you were glad you were covering and you were an eyewitness to a very major part of history?
A lot. For whatever reason, I seem to every time Mitt Romney made a really stupid gaffe, I seem to be there. I don't know if I jinxed him or what, but you know the corporations are people. He was in Tampa when he said he's been struggling without a job. Ha ha ha. Many people really were. I like to fire people. Every time Mitt Romney said something, I happened to be there to catch that. I had a yelling match once with Barack Obama.
Well, tell us about that.
if you remember, there were a couple times when Florida moved its primaries early, and so the Democratic Party nationally had a hissy fit. And at one point in 2004, the Democrat DNC, largely prodded by Barack Obama's campaign, decided the candidates have to boycott Florida. And so, I thought that was very offensive. The candidates could come in and raise money, but they couldn't. But they couldn't actually talk to human beings outside of fundraisers. So, I remember standing outside of a big high-dollar fundraiser on Spell Isle and shouting questions as Obama left, and he was stupid enough to answer me, shouting back at me. That was a moment. I asked him some question about the cat fund, and I remember the Secretary of State in New Hampshire called me. He's like, "You have some fund to help cats?" That was an insurance catastrophic fund.
So did you ever see Obama again? Did you ever get a chance to interview him in person again?
A bunch of times actually, and I'm pretty sure I had the very first interview in Florida with him. And he's sitting on his bus.
And what was your first take of Barack Obama?
You know, I think he's a very friendly, obviously very smart guy. He's not a warm and fuzzy. You know, there is a sort of a wall there, and I think at that time they were still a little skittish about Florida. It seemed to be Hillary Clinton country, and so. I think he had his guard up again. I do remember David Axelrod was sitting next to me, and he spilled his soda all over the bus, and Obama gave him a lot of hell for that.
We're talking with Adam Smith, who's stepping down today as the political editor of the Tampa Bay Times. He's moving on. He's taking a job in a local office of a public relations firm, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. I remember when Donald Trump came to town for the first time for a rally at the Sun Dome, and I think it was in 2015, he was running for president. You were there, and you got a ride in Donald Trump's limousine, if I remember that story correctly.
Yeah, I think I got the first Florida interview with him, and that's not because I'm so charming, even though I am. It's because Tampa Bay matters so much for these national candidates. You know, generally, as goes Tampa Bay, so goes Florida. And so, we're the biggest media outlet in Tampa Bay. So that's why I'm lucky enough to have gotten all those. My main memory there is I was supposed to get an interview with him. Then they canceled it. And Hope Hicks said, "No, we're not going to be able to do it." And then he said, "Oh, well, why doesn't he ride with us?" It was a last-minute thing, and I had no idea whether it was going to be a 2-minute ride, 5-minute ride, or 20-minute ride. So Trump, who, by the way, was very, very charming and nice, kept wanting to go off the record on stuff. And if you're a reporter and you've got 2 minutes and you need to have a story, I kept having to say, no, we can't go off the record. It turned out we got quite a bit of time with him.
And you were riding from the Sun Dome out to the Tampa International Airport?
It was actually the airport in Fenoda Sassa, Vandenberg. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I did get some decent time with them.
So your take on Trump was that he was charming, he was personable, he was a nice guy?
I don't think that's unusual. I think most people who meet him, there is a charisma. He's very... he actually, does like the press. You know, he has a love-hate relationship with the press. He certainly fixates on us. My daughter asked me the other day if I could interview one person in the world, who would it be? And I was sort of stumped. She said, "Wouldn't it be Trump?" And my answer was, no, it wouldn't be Trump because, he says one thing one day, it's very likely to be no longer operative an hour later. But you're never really going to be able to break a great deal of clear news to Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm. Adam, could I ask why you're leaving the Times?
Honestly, I think I've got the best job at this paper. I mean, politics in Tampa Bay and Florida is amazing, but I've been doing it a long time. And there were too many in the last couple months. There were things like, "Hey, let's do another I-4 corridor takeout," and or let's do a story on where does the beleaguered Florida Democratic Party go from here? And I just realized I couldn't muster much enthusiasm anymore for doing some of those stories for the umpteenth time.
A lot of great people have been in that position of the political editor of the Tampa Bay Times, Hal Raines and John Harwood, who's now on CNBC. Hal Raines, formerly of the New York Times. It's often seen as a kind of a stepping stone to, you know, Washington or New York, those kind of places.
Yeah, and I had some opportunities to do that. I found it was more interesting to be here, where you can sort of have the flexibility to do your own thing rather than be a pack in Washington, where you've got, you know, 40, 50 reporters largely doing the same thing. So, yeah, but nobody's done it for the Tampa Bay Times nearly as long as I. So I think that's why it's a grind. It's a lot of work. It's mostly a joy every day, but if I'm no longer enthusiastic every day, then it's time to go.
Wow. Adam Smith is here. He's the political editor of the Tampa Bay Times. He's stepping down today, and this is WMNF in Tampa. So just getting at the big picture, with the Republican wins last November, you know, Florida is often considered to be a purple state, but with the Republican wins last November, they now have really total control of Tallahassee and state government. Are we now a red state?
No, I don't think so at all. I mean, remember, tens of thousands of less than half a percentage point difference, and we would be talking about Florida's now a Democratic state, and there's been a sea change. You know, we just have election after election in an almost unbelievable way. It's decided by one percentage point. So I think in a midterm election, Republicans will always have an advantage. I think it's a tiny, tiny, tiny bit leaning Republican. Republicans tend to do a slightly better in Florida than they do nationally. But this is absolutely a swing state. What's so bizarre is how state government, you know, the Democratic Party is so irrelevant, whereas in a presidential election, it's pretty much of a coin toss.
So all 150 of the potential Democratic candidates are going to be campaigning here in Florida in the next 2 years.
Well, they will, but there's often this misperception in the Beltway and outside of Florida that Florida is kind of a red state. And I know Obama, for instance, who won twice, there was a great deal of debate about whether to play in Florida in the general election and whether it was worth it, right? Because people look at the result. They don't necessarily look deeper into the numbers and the demographics. It's never a sure thing how hard the Democrats play. They're always going to play somewhat to make Republicans spend money and time and resources. So whether they go full throttle is sometimes, who knows.
You know, a lot of people look at demographics and think demographics will determine what the state, what color the state is, whether it leans Democrat or leans Republican in the future. Do you think that Florida's on a demographic trend that leans either way?
I think if more likely than not, it's on a demographic trend that points toward the Democrats and helps the Democrats. But that depends on the Democrats continuing to do strongly among Hispanic voters and younger Cuban Americans, Puerto Ricans, etc., which is no sure thing. We saw Scott target those voters very well and Bill Nelson not do it so well. That's no sure thing for the long term, but for the medium term, that seems to be the trend. But the thing is often overlooked by some of the political press, like myself, is the white folk. You know, you can maybe do a half a percentage point better among black Floridians or Hispanic Floridians, but that's, you know, you do a half a percentage better among white voters. There's still a strong majority. You know, you've got to do 4 or 5 points better among Hispanic voters to make up for a 1% improvement for Republicans among white voters. So I think that's the bigger problem for the immediate future.
Well, our guest is Adam Smith. He's stepping down today as the political editor at the Tampa Bay Times. He's held that seat for 17 years, and this is WMNF in Tampa. So tell me about journalism. I mean, do newspapers have a future? Because we've seen a lot of great people leave the Times. The Tampa Tribune closed a few years ago. And for my money, the best reporting is done by newspaper reporters. But do newspapers have a future, do you think?
Yeah, I think they absolutely do. I think that the business model hasn't quite worked out yet. I'm not sure if the paper product has a long-term future at all, but in some form or another, there is going to be a newspaper or online newspaper. I mean, I do think that is literally the greatest threat to democracy is how many major cities. We're very, very lucky, even though the Times had some tough times, and I think we're doing pretty decently right now. But you've got major great American cities, New Orleans, Denver, Detroit, all over the place that really have no vibrant outlet at all because the newspapers are virtually gone.
And I think that's where the most consistent enterprise and investigative reporting comes out of is newspapers. I mean, TV can be great, but there's no substitute for newspaper reporters doing an investigative piece that might take 6 months and coming up with something spectacular.
That's absolutely right. I mean, there was a paper on the inside of the B section in the Tampa Bay Times about the Pinellas or the St. Petersburg Housing Authority, where they were going to start quietly giving themselves 2% of the take of housing deals, real estate development deals. I mean, that is freaking outrageous. People lining their pockets, and the only way that happens is because they think nobody's watching. And in most cities, nobody is watching. But that's the real problem. Is what are the developers doing? What's happening with the contracting, et cetera? That's what I really worry about. And that's why, as much as the Tampa Bay Times may infuriate people on a day-to-day basis on the left and the right, or people may say, oh, it's not what it used to be, you know, this is an extraordinarily important asset for the region.
So is it easier being a reporter today, or was it easier being a political reporter 17 years ago? How has access to newsmakers changed?
I don't know if it's easier, because certainly technology is a whole lot easier than when we were working with pagers and typewriters, and the internet didn't exist virtually. But yeah, access more and more. I mean, I remember when I started, my first presidential election was 2004, and I would travel with some of the major candidates, John Kerry, Howard Dean, Dick Gephardt, you know, just he and I and a staffer in a car for hours and hours. That, I think, is, you know, unless you're talking about a real long shot candidate, those days are gone in a big way. And even in state elections, statewide elections, you know, the candidates will talk about a bus tour, Rick Scott or Ron DeSantis, but usually it's a bus in which reporters are invited on for 20 minutes between stops and then hustled off the bus. So certainly access is a lot less.
And you mentioned there the Democratic candidates in the primary. The Times usually, if I'm right, assigns one reporter to cover the Democratic side, or maybe the leading Democratic candidate, and then it assigns another reporter to cover the Republican side or the leading Republican candidate. Is that the way it works?
Yeah, and usually we'd have somebody focusing on the Democrat, somebody focusing on the Republican, and that would be both in the Senate race and the Democrat and the governor's race in a state elect cycle. And then I would sort of float and try to do the bigger picture stories rather than the day-to-day stuff. And I think that, you know, one of the reasons I was so lucky is because this paper has always had a big, big commitment to government and political reporting. That's always been, you know, that and narrative writing and increasingly investigative, more and more of a priority. But those have been sort of niches.
Well, speaking of that, some of the Times' biggest stories have come out of Tallahassee, where both the Times and the Tampa Tribune and all the other major papers in the state, if you go back 15 years or so, had major groups of reporters up there covering the legislature, and I think Tallahassee is really lower Alabama. It's really not part of Florida because it's so far away, and Tallahassee doesn't really represent what the most of the state looks like. But there's all sorts of potential for hanky-panky on all sorts of levels up there in Tallahassee, and that's where the Times has broken some of its best stories. But now all the papers are cutting back their Tallahassee presence, aren't they?
Big time, big time. You know, we're still lucky. We made a decision some years ago to team up with the Miami Herald, with the idea being, really wasn't a cost saving as much as the idea being, well, you know, we have two strong, strong bureaus. Why have both of us cover the same fairly insignificant press conference when you can have one reporter doing that and the other's focusing on something else? But, yeah, it's a fraction of what it used to be. But I will say, you know, I often hear people wringing their hands that State House coverage has been just gutted. Florida still has a pretty strong State House press corps. And, you know, as some of the papers have cut back significantly, you've got things like News Service of Florida and Politico Florida that are covering some of this stuff. Now, unfortunately, a lot of that is behind a paywall, or there are sites that really are catering toward lobbyists far more than anybody else. But, you know, there is at least a good amount of scrutiny on what's happening up there still.
Well, isn't that a danger if lobbyists are funding some of these news websites? And that's not exactly what you said, but that is what's happening.
You're right.
So is there a danger that we get some of these stories from these Tallahassee-based websites or statewide websites, and oftentimes some of these sites don't reveal who pays the bills, so what happens? I mean, how are we to trust that?
Yeah, I think that is a danger, and it kind of goes along with the whole notion that there needs to be a real effort in America to promote sort of media literacy, that, you know, all the fake news stuff that was going on Facebook and the bots, et cetera, and the BS stories that are out there, you know, that combined with some of the sources that either have a paid agenda or, are just shoddy journalism, it's getting harder and harder and more important for people to be able to distinguish and do their homework.
Adam, in the early parts of any campaign, whether it's a gubernatorial campaign or a senatorial campaign or a presidential campaign, the field of candidates is really big. And a lot of people think they can be the next U.S. senator or the next U.S. president. Do you have an award for, not that you have done this yet, but I'm going to put you out on a limb, the strangest candidate you ever covered?
Yeah, that's got to be Catherine Harris.
Why?
Who was not a long shot candidate, but she was. She went through so many different staffs, and there was, you know, sort of an element of God is telling her to do this and that. I remember somebody on her campaign, a very prominent national figure, said to me, "You know, I've spent my entire life working with candidates who talk to God every day, but this is the first time I've had somebody who says God talks to them every day." And you know, that got to be a more than bizarre campaign.
And she's still around, but she keeps a very low profile.
She does keep a very low profile. I will say that to me, the most bizarre, most fun election cycle was 2010. And that's where you had Charlie Crist, the seemingly invincible governor running for Senate and viewing himself as a vice president or president, you know, overtaken by Marco Rubio. You know, like Rick Scott come out of nowhere to crush Bill McCollum. And you had this billionaire Jeff Green suddenly pop up and start trying to beat Kendrick Meek. That was an amazing cycle where it was hard to keep our head above water.
Yeah, there were so many story angles there. Well, Adam, I'm really sorry you're leaving the Times. I mean, I love newspapers, and I think that's where I get the best information. And, you know, even if I spend 5 hours watching TV, I frequently don't get as much information is if I spend 10 or 15 minutes reading the front section of a newspaper.
I agree, but I also will say I'm very optimistic. I think this is the industry will find its footing, and you may not be able to have ink on your fingers forever, but I think newspapers in one form or another will be around for a long, long time. It's too important to go away.
Yeah, is there anything else that you would like to tell us about your tenure there at the Times or about leaving the Times? Any other final thought?
Do what you can. When we have a paywall again, subscribe. Pay. It's not much, and you are sustaining something that is critical for a good community. If you can get a paper subscription, do it. And I'm not going away. I'm still sticking around Tampa Bay, so people could still take shots at me or say hello anytime.
All right. Well, Adam Smith, thanks a lot for coming on WMNF, and good luck in your next venture.
Thanks, Rob. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Adam. All right. That's Adam Smith, who's stepping down today as the political editor of the Tampa Bay Times. He's been there for 17 years. Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. Let's take some phone calls. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. Email address, dj@wmnf.org. Suzanne writes, this is the position Adam's taking out of town. She goes on to say, I hope he'll still be on your Friday night show from time to time. I think that's still a possibility. I'll write Adam and see if that's still a possibility when he takes his new job. Suzanne, thanks for that email. And our phone number is 813-239-9663. Bill Grace is our phone supervisor today, and he'll be picking up the phone and bringing you on the air. Let's take a few phone calls right now, and I'll read some more emails in a second. Let's go to John in St. Pete. Hey, John, you're on WMNF.
Hello.
Hi, John.
I was just curious to ask Adam if he thinks the felon right to vote now is going to push it, you know, to a Democratic state more than a Republican. So I'm quite interested to find out, since we're so close on elections, and that's a whole lot of new voters coming in, what he would think about that.
Yeah, I don't know. Adam had a lunch meeting he had to go to, so he left us. But that is a real interesting thing. Let me read from the newspaper, speaking of the federal right to vote. And maybe this is the story you're talking about, John. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said yesterday that a Democratic bill that would make Election Day a federal holiday is a power grab. That's his quote, sparking a fierce backlash online. McCollum was speaking about H.R. 1. That's legislation that Democrats have made a centerpiece of their agenda since retaking the House earlier this month. In remarks on the Senate floor, McConnell, who's a Republican from Kentucky, said Democrats want taxpayers on the hook for generous new benefits for federal bureaucrats and government employees, including making Election Day a new paid holiday for government workers. The far-reaching legislation would also prohibit the purging of voter rolls, require presidential and vice presidential candidates to release their tax returns, compel states to adopt independent redistricting commissions, and create a matching system for small dollar donations to congressional campaigns, among other changes. McConnell has mocked the legislation as the Democrat Politician Protection Act. Senator Brian Schatz, a Democrat from Hawaii, tweeted a retort yesterday afternoon by saying, voting is a power grab, period, by citizens. So anyway, is that the bill you were talking about, the right, the federal voting rights?
No. Yep. No, actually, what I'm talking about is their state, you know, allowing the felons to vote.
Oh, yeah,
Because the assumption is every felon is a Democrat.
Yeah, and I've done a couple of shows about that, and I know Midpoint shows has done a couple of shows about that. Not every ex-felon is a Democrat. In fact, we've run across quite a number who are Republicans who are independents. So it's not an automatic lock. The big question is how many of that 1.4 million people will actually sign up and register to vote. And
since our margin is only a percentage point, we don't need all of them to vote.
Democrats lose by about even less than one half of one percentage point.
How many people is that really? Do we really need to vote to make a change?
Well, if you're talking about the Democratic Party winning, and I'm not speaking for the Democrats, but let's just say that we were advising Democrats, that's about 25 or 30,000 votes that they would need to tip in their direction.
That seems highly achievable. You know, I mean, that that large number of people.
Yeah. Well, John, we'll see. I mean, that's going to be one of the big issues leading up to 2020. How many of the people who are newly allowed to vote under Amendment 4, how many of them will actually vote? The other big question, John, is it appears that the state legislature is going to get involved and try to put its thumb on Amendment 4. There's all
they
sorts
always
of,
do that.
Yeah, and they've done that since the days of the lottery and every other amendment passed by Florida voters. So it looks like this session in March, they're going to try to put the thumb on Amendment 4. So we'll cover it. I promise we'll cover it.
I'm a medical marijuana person, and I'm quite interested to see what the governor does. Now they say that the state Senate president's going to fight him on smokable marijuana. You know, it's just... Everything's obstructionist with Republican Party.
I think in Governor DeSantis's case, he just had a press conference in Orlando about 10 days ago, and he's in favor of upholding smokable marijuana. I think that was the upshot of that press conference. So,
unfortunately, the Senate and the House of Representatives don't quite agree with that.
We'll pay attention. I think the governor in this case might have some pull. We'll see. All right, John, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
All right. Our current governor, Ron DeSantis, who's a Republican, held a press conference with John Morgan just a few days ago in Orlando and talked about saying that the voters approve medical marijuana, even in its smokable form. And let's go to Amy in St. Pete. Hi, Amy. You're on WMNF.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. This is a very momentous time in regional media history that Adam Smith is stepping down. And I just wanted to say that media is such a sacred American institution. It is the one foundation of our democracy. And just reflecting on the legacy that Adam Smith has left, I want to say I hope now there is an opportunity for the Times in this region to really have a conversation about media ethics. Because I ran for office in the last election cycle, and I had a firsthand experience with the way in which Adam Smith and his writing team has weaponized media. It's profoundly politically biased. It is profoundly unethical. There have been legal claims brought against the Times that were won with what happened with Jeff Green's run in 2010. And I really think it's time for us to have a conversation about media ethics, because media has never been scrutinized more than right now. It's been attacked by our president, and it is so important that we are protecting people who share truth with the voting electorate. But with that power comes great responsibility. And it should be people who decide elections and not powerful newspapers. So thank you very much.
All right, Amy, thanks a lot. Thank you, Amy. Good to hear from you. 813-239-9663. Well, if you want to comment about something you've heard here in the last hour, you can email your comment into the studio. And our address is dj@wmnf.org. Here's somebody cheekily writing, if you include a loaf of warm Cuban bread with the delivery of the newspaper in the morning, I'm willing to spend $3 per day, writes actually Ruben in Lakeland. All right. And here's an unsigned email. Says, Florida Democrats did better in the last midterms, winning state House and state Senate and federal House and county seats, thanks to Andrew Gillum and Sanders and the youth turnout, writes Anonymous. Thank you for that. Yeah, more young people turned out, especially in cities that have high college populations. The turnout among college-age students, was really high during that last election. And then, let's see, Anonymous writes this. Artificial intelligence accumulating algorithms will eventually have not much use for many people. We are the input, she writes. Journalists, too, will be affected. Read up on it if you don't know about it, writes Anonymous. Okay, Anonymous, thank you for that. Bob writes this, local newspapers are our last connection to investigative journalism that actually matters locally. Local television and cable news currently is nothing but commentary and reporting only whatever comes over their police scanner, writes Bob in Tarpon Springs. I think there are some good investigative reporters at local TV stations, but, you know, just think, back in the day, and these numbers aren't exactly right, but back in the day, there might have been, in a healthy newspaper newsroom, whether it's the Tampa Tribune or what used to be called the St. Petersburg Times, there might have been 200 or 300 people in a healthy newsroom, including editors, writers, reporters, photographers. Now those newsrooms, the Tribune newsroom has gone away. We still have the Lakeland Ledger, but their newsroom is smaller. The Sarasota Herald Tribune's newsroom is smaller. I can remember going to news events covering things down in downtown Tampa where there would be 6 or 7 or 8 reporters covering the same event, sometimes even bigger crowds, depending on the importance of the news. And then today, when Sean goes out and covers a story, there might only be 1 or 2 reporters in the room. I was at a mayoral event the other night, and there were probably 400 people in the audience, maybe 300 people in the audience, but there were only a total of 3 reporters in the room who were covering the event. So we're far down from our heyday here of what it used to be. 813-239-9663 is our phone number. Let's go to Norman in Zephyr Hills. Hey, Norman, you're on M&F.
Hello.
Hi.
I only caught part of the conversation about the war with that gentleman.
Yeah, with Andrew Bacevich.
Okay. Thank you. I do have a couple comments, though. Very much do I hate war. If you think about it, mankind has been fighting for 7,000 years. And has anybody really won yet? And most of it seems to be centered on the Middle East. There's a song written by Graham Nash. It's called Military Madness, and I wish you people would play it.
Yeah, we play it a lot. We play it a lot on the 60s show, and I think we play it on the Freak Show, too. But it's a great song. It's on Graham's solo album.
Yeah. Exactly. Yep. I keep happening to miss it, evidently. I do love the 60s and 70s shows on Saturday, absolutely. Plus you and Mr. Gilmore. I wish some of your shows, like Gilmore, could go 2 hours, but I know how it is. But thank you.
All right, Norman. Thanks a lot. Thank you for that. All right. Good to hear from you. 813-239-9663. Email address dj@wmnf.org. Here's an email from somebody in Jacksonville. It says, I've been a Republican all my life, and I went to prison after having run for state house on the Republican ticket when I went to work for a billionaire. After I got out, my mother passed away, and now I'm living on the streets in Jacksonville. All right, so there's an email from one of our listeners living on the streets, listening to WMNF. How about that? In the next hour, you're going to hear the Midpoint program. This is WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. And we're going to go to Hugh in Dover. Hugh, you're on WMNF. We just have about 30 seconds.
Yeah, Sean, real quick, I just want to know, does the National News Service and the Allied Press, do they still exist, and do the Tampa Times, do they contribute or take any information from that line?
Okay, thanks. Thanks for that question. There is a national news cooperative called the Associated Press, and most TV, radio stations, and newspapers belong to it. The Tampa Bay Times does contribute to the Associated Press, and it carries stories from the Associated Press. We carry stories from the Associated Press, in fact. And that National News Cooperative still exists. It's a nonprofit jointly owned by all of its members. And that does. And I've got my problems with it because I think some of the editing is not as precise as it should. The other day they were talking about single-payer health care and the Kaiser survey about the popularity of single-payer health care. And in the context of the broadcast story, they called single-payer a government takeover of health care. And single-payer is really not a government takeover of health care. Single-payer means that instead of having private insurance companies, we would have government as the insurance company. Anyway, so if you want to comment about today's show, please call us up at 813-238-8001 or record your comment on extension 115. And I'll play your comments back tomorrow at 11 o'clock. Now stay tuned for Shelley Reback and Lynn Marvin Dingfelder on the Midpoint program. This is WMNF in Tampa.